Part 13. The Diaphanous. It appears that the radical element responsible for the continuing thread of cosmic unrest is the magnetic field. What, then, is a magnetic field that, like a biological form, is able to reproduce itself and carry on an active life in the general outflow of starlight, and from there alter the behavior of stars and galaxies? Eugene Parker, Cosmical Magnetic Fields. 39. Carl said, "It's a standing kink." Beth looked at the screen showing the jet, its plasma and magnetic densities highlighted in color. "This is a snap of it?" "No, it's real time. The sideways movement of the jet in the knothole region is hung up, lashing against the mag bumpers meant to keep it away." A side excursion had forked over against one of the life zones, penetrating the atmospheric envelope of a pie-shaped wedge.
"How in the hell did that happen?" Redwing asked from over Beth's shoulder.
Carl grimaced. "We've been driving our fusion burn pretty hard, trying to get some distance from the flyers that are coming up at us in the jet."
"And failing," Redwing added.
"So that added our plume to the plasma already forcing the kink instability. Nonlinear mechanics at work. The kink has gotten to some mode where it snags against the mag defenses and just stays there." Carl shrugged, as if to say, "Don't blame me, it's nonlinear."
"So it's getting worse down there," Beth said.
Her eyes were always on the shifting screens as they powered away from their pursuers. In the howling maelstrom of the jet, there were always vagrant pressures, sudden snarling knots of turbulence, shifts in Sunseeker's mag-scoop configuration. Now Sunseeker had Mayra Wickram Singh and Ayan Ali as backup navigator pilot, since Claire Conway had died in an instant's sudden lightning flash through the excited air above the bridge deck. That had been only an hour ago, but the sharp terror of it was already fading in memory. There was too much to do now, to think of what had happened. Beth had helped carry away the charred corpse, holding Claire by the arms, seeing the face that was swollen and already darkening. Only hours ago she had seen that mouth smiling, laughing. Beth heard her own voice rattling out.
"Those flitters, as you call them, Captain, are coming up fast."
Her eyes studied the slim, quick shapes, just barely defined in size by their microwave radars. They had spread into a triangle centered on Sunseeker's wake. Redwing stood in the middle of the bridge and said to everyone,
"We're plainly about to go into battle. Those flitters are fast. We can't outrun them. So we've got to engage them with a ship not designed to do battle at all."
Silence. Jem Podvipa usually said little, but now she said quietly, "Is there any advantage in leaving the jet?" Beth knew Redwing should answer that, but she seethed with anger now and could not stop herself.
"I don't want to maneuver against craft that fast, with our only fuel the star's solar wind, or what's left of it. The jet gets over 90% of the plasma that leaves the star. I can't fly hard with no mass coming through the scoop."
Carl LeBannon asked, head bowed, "What do the flitters fly on?"
"Not plasma, right?" Redwing turned to Beth.
"Their plume shows fusion burners, but they're running on boron proton. They carry their fuel and reaction mass."
"They're flying upstream, which costs them in momentum," Carl said.
"For us, it's gain. We get more charged mass down the mag scoop gullet. So, what do we do when we get to gunplay?" Redwing asked. "We got no guns aboard, Dr. LeBannon."
Beth said, "You've got the big gun, Captain. The torch." Redwing nodded somberly.
"You think it can make that much difference?"
Carl said, "Whatever's flying the flitters, Ardalex or aliens, it has to be vulnerable to the jet. They have magnetic screens for sure. They must have been engineered to take care of problems in the jet." Beth turned her back on Carl, irritated that he had jumped in when Redwing clearly addressed his question to her.
"So, if we push them harder, give them some twist, maybe we can keep them at a distance, dodge them. Not like there's not room to play out here in the jet."
Redwing scowled, his face more lined than she had ever seen.
"It's 10 light seconds across. Room to dodge, but can we keep them far enough away?"
"Depends on what their weaponry is." Carl wore a dispassionate expression, staring into space.
Nuclear, sure, we can see hardware coming and hit it with our scoop-policing lasers. But if they have gamma-ray lasers like those big domes on the bowl rim, we're done.
Beth sat back and watched the flitters edge up from behind. She bit her lip, adjusted for a vortex plasma knot, felt it surge them to starboard, and said, even and controlled,
"Captain, we don't have much choice."
Red Wing was silent, pacing, frowning. More silence. And suddenly Beth found herself on her feet, speaking in a flat, hard voice.
"You ordered us into the jet. You wanted to press the folk. Claire got killed right here. And you now have no idea what to do?"
Red Wing spun on his heel.
"I have over 1,000 souls aboard who signed on to go to glory. I took an oath to deliver them. I didn't agree to turn them over to aliens riding along in a big contraption."
"I don't think..."
"Point is, your job is to not think beyond your rank."
"We all just saw Claire killed by something we don't understand. That's got us all terrified, and you..."
"Quiet,"
Jam said, rising to her height on the deck, her dark face severe.
"The captain commands. We do not question, especially under combat conditions."
Beth stared at Jam, whom she recalled was a mere petty officer, but she had to admit Jam was right.
"I..."
Beth's throat filled, choking off her words.
"Claire..."
"Enough," Red Wing said, addressing all the bridge crew. "We're all jumpy. Forget this happened. We are committed and we shall engage."
He turned to Beth.
"But you're lead pilot. You are carrying this ship into a battle we cannot master without you. Do it."
So she did.